with the affable condescension of a visiting congressman. Second Lieutenant Walter Jessel was the American intelligence officer originally in charge of interrogating Von Braun. His first and most lasting impression was the lack of remorse. There is recognition of Germany's defeat, but none whatsoever of Germany's guilt and responsibility. So confident were Von Braun and Dornberger about their value to the U.S. Army, they demanded to see General Eisenhower, whom they called Ike. Another observer noted, "If we hadn't caught the biggest scientist in the Third Reich, we certainly caught the biggest liar." Hitler's chemists, sought after as they were nowhere to be found. It was early May, and the 7th Army was in control of the beautiful old city of Heidelberg, located on the Neckar River. 25 agents attached to the U.S. military government's Cartels Division, including clerks with OSS and the Foreign Economic Division, had descended on the town looking for board members from IG Farben. In addition to being wanted for war crimes, the IG Farben Board of Directors was being investigated for international money laundering schemes. A number of high-ranking Farben executives were known to have houses in Heidelberg, but to date, no one had been able to find Hermann Schmitz, the company's powerful and secretive CEO. Schmitz was also a director of the Deutsche Reichsbank, the German Central Bank, and director of the Bank for International Settlements in Geneva. He was believed to be the wealthiest banker in all of Germany. The reason no one had been able to locate Hermann Schmitz was not because he was hiding out or had fled, but because officers were going around Heidelberg looking for Schmitz Castle. Despite the vast wealth he had accumulated during the war, Hermann Schmitz was actually a miser. He lived in a modest, if not ugly, little house. No one would associate the legend of Schmitz with the house he lived in, Nuremberg prosecutor Josiah Dubois recalled after the war. Working on a tip and as part of a door-to-door search for suspected war criminals, a group of enlisted soldiers knocked on the door of a stucco pillbox of a house, overlooking the city, where a short man with a red face and a thick neck answered the door. Behind him, on a placard nailed to the wall, it was written that God was the head of this house. Schmitz had dark eyes and a goatee and was accompanied by his wife, described by soldiers as a dumpy Frau in a crisp gingham dress. Frau Schmitz offered the soldiers coffee, but Schmitz intervened and told her no. Schmitz said he had no interest in answering the questions of the enlisted men whom he considered beneath him. If an officer came to speak with him, Schmitz said he might have something to say. The men conducted a cursory search of the house. Schmitz's office was plainly furnished and contained nothing expensive or of any obvious value. Searching through his desk, however, the soldiers learned that Schmitz had friends in high places. They found a collection of birthday telegrams sent from Hitler and Göring, both of whom addressed Schmitz as Justizrats, Doctor of Laws. "Doctor of Laws Schmitz," the soldiers asked, mocking him. "How much money do you have in this house, and where is it?" Schmitz declined to say, and the soldiers were only able to locate a small stash of about 15,000 Reichsmarks, or about half the annual salary of a field marshal. So they left, letting Schmitz know that they would return the following day. On the second day, Schmitz let the soldiers back in. This time, the soldiers found an air raid shelter behind the house, where Schmitz had hidden a trunk filled with IG Farben documents. There was still not enough evidence to justify arresting Schmitz. It would be a few more days until an incredible discovery was made. When SIOS team leader Major Tilly learned that Hermann Schmitz had been located, he rushed to Heidelberg. Tilly and Tarr had been leading the SIOS chemical weapons mission across Germany. Ever since they had discovered the Tabin nerve agent cache hidden in the forest outside the robber's lair, They had been looking for Farben executives. Now they had the man at the top. If anyone could skillfully interrogate Hermann Schmitz, Major Tilly could. Not only did he speak fluent German, but he was deeply conversant on the subject of chemical warfare. In Heidelberg, Tilly went directly to Schmitz's house. He suggested that the two men discuss a few things in Herr Schmitz's private study. Schmitz said that would be fine. Tilly asked the Farben CEO a series of banal questions, all the while tapping on the walls of Schmitz's study. Slowly, Tilly made his way around the room this way, listening for any inconsistencies in the way the walls were built. Schmitz grew increasingly uncomfortable. Finally, he began to cry. Tilly had found what he was looking for, a secret safe buried in Schmitz's office wall. Hermann Schmitz was one of the wealthiest bankers in Germany and one of the most important players in the economics of the Third Reich. What secret was contained in his safe? Major Tilly instructed Schmitz to open it. Inside, lying flat, was a photo album. The photographs were in a wooden inlaid cover dedicated to Hermann Schmitz on his 25th jubilee, possibly as a Farben director. Tilly explained in a PSYOS intelligence report. Tilly lifted out the photo album from its hiding place, flipped open the cover, and began reviewing the pictures. On page one of the scrapbook, the word Auschwitz was written. Tilly's eyes scanned over a picture of a street in a Polish village. Next to the photograph was a cartoonish drawing depicting individuals who had once been part of the Jewish population who lived there, portrayed in a manner that was not flattering to them, Tilly explained. The caption underneath the cartoon read, "The Old Auschwitz, as it was, Auschwitz in 1940. At this point, Tilly wrote in his PSYOS report, he was surprised at how highly emotional Schmitz became. What Tilly did not yet know was that he was looking at Schmitz's secret photo album that chronicled the building history of Farben's labor concentration camp, IG Auschwitz, from the very start. In May of 1945, almost no one, including Major Tilly, had any idea what really had happened at Auschwitz, that at least 1.1 million people had been exterminated there. The facts about the camp had not yet come to light. On January 27, 1945, Soviet troops liberated Auschwitz, and Red Army photographers took film footage and photographs of the atrocities they discovered there. But that information had not yet been shared openly with the rest of the world. A short report about the extermination camp had appeared in Stalinovsk Zamnaya, the Red Army's newspaper, on January 28, 1945. Stalin was waiting to release the bulk of information until after Germany surrendered. What was clear to Major Tilly was that this photo album was important to Schmitz and that he wanted it to remain hidden. Why exactly, Major Tilly had no idea. As PSYOS team leader, Major Tilly was on a hunt for Farben chemists who had developed nerve gas. Hermann Schmitz, while important to Farben in the bigger picture, was not a chemist. He claimed to have no idea where the Farben chemists had gone. The scrapbook was taken into evidence, and Tilly moved on in his search. Meanwhile, in southern Germany, in an Austrian border town called Gindorf, the man Major Tilly was really looking for, Dr. Otto Ambrose, had just been located by U.S. Army soldiers. The soldiers had no idea who Ambrose really was. When American soldiers rolled into the town of Gindorf, about 60 miles southeast of Munich, they noticed one man in particular because he stood out like a sore thumb. This first encounter with Ambrose, later recounted at the Nuremberg trials, stuck out in the soldiers' minds because Ambrose had been dressed in a fancy suit to greet the victors. The man hardly looked like he'd been through a war. The soldiers asked the man his rank and serial number. "My name is Otto Ambrose," he said, smiling. He added that he was not a military man, but a plain chemist. Was he German? The soldiers asked. Yes, I am German, Ambrose replied and made a joke. He said that he had so many French friends, he could almost be considered a Frenchman. In fact, his true home was in Ludwigshafen, on the border with France. He told the soldiers that the reason he was here in southern Bavaria was because he was the director of a large business concern called IG Farben. The company had a detergent factory here in Gindorf, Ambrose explained. As a Farben board member, he'd been asked to oversee production. German society might be experiencing a collapse, he told the soldiers, but everyone needed to stay clean. The soldiers asked to be taken to the detergent factory. Inside, they inspected huge vats of soap and other cleaning products. Work at the factory appeared to have been uninterrupted by the war. Ambrose took the soldiers to his office, where someone had taped a rainbow of color spectrum cards to the wall. In addition to cleaning products, the facility made lacquers, Ambrose explained. The soldiers looked around, thanked Ambrose for the tour, and asked him not to leave town. I have no reason to flee, said Ambrose. The soldiers noted how much he smiled. Over the next few days, more soldiers arrived in Gindorf. These filthy, grime-covered American GIs were delighted when the so-called plain chemist offered them free bars of soap. Some of the soldiers hadn't washed in more than a month. The chemist's generosity did not stop there. Otto Ambrose gave the soldiers powerful cleaning solvents so that they could wash their mud-covered armored tanks. Soldiers interviewed Otto Ambrose a second time. This time, Ambrose voluntarily offered up character witnesses. Working at the Farben factory in Gindorf were skinny men with shaved heads. Ambrose said they were war refugees and that they could vouch for his kindness as a boss. They were from Poland, just across the border to the east. Ambrose told the soldiers that he had personally brought these poor workers here to Gindorf. He'd hand-picked the men and trained them how to work hard. This way, when the refugees went home, they would have skills that could help them earn a living, Ambrose explained. The skinny refugees were quiet and said nothing to dispute the plain chemist's claims. Some of them even helped the American soldiers wash their tanks. Otto Ambrose was a talkative man. He regaled the Americans with stories about the joys of chemistry. For example, did the soldiers realize what a miracle it was that man could make 100 wonders from a single chemical compound like ethylene oxide? Or how amazing rubber was? Ambrose told the soldiers that he'd been to Ceylon, where the rubber plant grows. Rubber had so much in common with man, Ambrose said. He was a rubber expert, so he knew this to be fact. Rubber was civilized, neat and perfect if kept clean. Ambrose told the soldiers that a rubber factory and a man must always be very clean. A single flake of dust or dirt in a vat of liquid rubber could mean a blowout on the Autobahn one day. IG Farben had synthetic rubber factories and, like natural rubber, the laboratories and factories must always be kept perfectly clean. Ambrose talked a lot, but he did not mention anything about the rubber factory he had built and managed at Auschwitz. The soldiers thanked him for his generosity with the soap and the cleaning agents. Before they left, they reminded Ambrose again that it was important he not leave town. He was technically under house arrest. When American officials of higher rank finally arrived in Gindorf a few days later, they had more specific questions for Ambrose. Why was part of the Farben detergent factory built underground? It would take months for SIOS investigators to learn that the factory here in Gindorf produced chemical weapons during the war, and that after Ambrose had fled Auschwitz in late January 1945, he and his deputy, Jürgen von Klink, had come to Gindorf to destroy evidence, hide documents, and disguise the factory so that it appeared to produce only detergents and soap. In Munich, on May 17, 1945, U.S. soldiers at a checkpoint were conducting a routine identification request when a well-dressed man, 134 pounds, 5'9", with dark black hair, hazel eyes, and a pronounced dueling scar on the left side of his face between his nose and his upper lip, presented a German passport bearing the name Professor Dr. Friedrich Ludwig Kurt Blomme. Dr. Blomme's name triggered an alert. Immediate arrest, first priority. Samuel Goudsmit and the entire team of biological warfare experts with Operation Alsace had been on the hunt for Dr. Blomme. Agent Arnold Veith with the Army's Counterintelligence Corps made the arrest. Agent Veith completed the necessary paperwork while the prisoner was processed. Dr. Blomme was sent to the 12th Army Group Interrogation Center for questioning. Several days later, a document arrived via teletype from the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, America's wartime espionage agency and the precursor to the CIA. They, too, had been searching for Dr. Blomme. The War Crimes Office had considerable information about Dr. Kurt Blomme. He was Deputy Surgeon General of the Third Reich and Vice President of the Reich's Physicians League, Reichsarztkammer. He was believed to have reported directly to Göring and maybe even Himmler or to both. Blomme had been named head of Reich Cancer Research in 1942. Alsace and OSS presumed that this was a cover name for biological weapons work. Blomme was a dedicated and proud Nazi. His book, Arzt im Kampf, Doctor in Battle, compared a doctor's struggle with the struggle of the Third Reich. Soldiers, officers, and doctors weren't all that different, each constantly in battle against invading forces and disease. Investigators were trying to piece together the labyrinthine medical hierarchy of the Third Reich so as to understand who was in charge of what organization. Particularly interesting to the interrogators was the fact that Dr. Kurt Blomme had been part of a top-tier group of Nazi doctors who focused on hygiene. This word connotated disease control, but was also believed to have been used by the Reich as a euphemism for ethnic cleansing and extermination of Jews. Alsace was in possession of correspondence between Blomme and Himmler that discussed giving certain groups of sick individuals, in this case tubercular Poles, special treatment, Sonderbehandlung. What exactly did special treatment mean? At the time of Blomme's capture and interrogation, Allied intelligence agencies believed that there was only one physician higher than Blomme in the hierarchy of the Reich Hygiene Committee, and that was the notorious Reich Health Leader, Reichsgesundheitsführer, Leonardo Conti. Dr. Blomme spoke fluent English with his first army interrogator. He described himself as a good Nazi, obedient, and promised that he was willing to cooperate with the Allies. At first, his interrogators were thrilled by the prospect of learning more about Reich medicine from such a big fish as Dr. Blomme. "Why was he cooperating?" Blomme was asked. "I cannot approve of the way new advances in medical science have been used for atrocities," declared Dr. Blomme. "What kind of atrocities?" Blomme's investigator wanted to know. Blomme stated that in his capacity as Deputy Surgeon General of the Reich, he had observed new scientific studies and experiments which led to later atrocities, e.g. mass sterilization, gassing of Jews. It was an astonishing admission. Until Dr. Blomme gave up this information so freely, no physician in the inner circle had admitted to having known about such wide-scale atrocities as mass murder and sterilization programs. That Blomme was willing to talk was extremely promising news. Blomme was cooperative and intelligent, noted his interrogator. Most important, he was willing to supply information. But the U.S. investigators' excitement did not last long. By his next interrogation, Dr. Kurt Blomma had shut down entirely. He told his interrogating officer, Major E. W. B. Gill, that he had only ever been an administrator for the Reich, that he did nothing hands-on. Major Gill pressed Blomma for information about his direct superior, Dr. Leonardo Conti. Blomma said he knew nothing about Conti's job. When I pointed out that the deputy must presumably know something about his chief's job, Major Gill wrote in his report, he said the organization was extremely complicated and really he would like to draw me a diagram on it. Gill lost his temper. I told Blomma I didn't want his damn diagrams, but an answer to a simple question. How did he take Conti's place if he, Conti, were absent or ill, if he knew nothing of the job? Blomma repeated his position, that it was all too complicated to explain to a man like Major Gill. Outraged by the sidestepping, Gill kept at it. But by the end of Blomma's Alsace interrogation, Major Gill had been unable to get even a scrap of new information from Blomma. He claimed never to have heard of the majority of the names of fellow doctors that Major Gill asked him about. Instead, Blomma insisted that he knew nothing about the medical chain of command inside the Third Reich or the SS, despite the fact that he had personally met with Himmler 5 times since 1943. Gill asked how Blomma, a cancer expert, had been put in charge of the Reich's bioweapons program, a subject he claimed to know very little about. Blomma said he had no answer for that. On my suggestion that a most important branch of war research would not be assigned to a complete ignoramus, he, after endless explanations of the complexity of the German world, finally said it must have been because, as an undergraduate, he wrote on BW, biological weapons, as his thesis for a doctorate. Major Gill felt for certain that Dr. Blomma was lying. But there was nothing he could do except present Blomma with information and evidence that Alsace had compiled about him since they had seized Dr. Eugen Hagen's apartment 6 months before. Gill told Blomma that in a series of interrogations with 16 Reich doctors also involved in bioweapons-related research, Alsace officers had learned about many horrific medical crimes. Gill explained that Alsace had documents that tied Blomma to the crimes. For example, Alsace had found letters inside the apartment of Dr. Eugen Hagen that linked Dr. Blomma to Dr. Hagen, and also to an SS colleague named Dr. August Hurt. These letters made clear that someone was providing Reich doctors with human guinea pigs. Who exactly was in charge of this program? Gill asked Blomma. Gill needed a name. Blomma denied having any idea what Gill was referring to. Major Gill told Blomma he had a letter that implicated Blomma. In another letter, Gill said, Dr. Blomma had instructed Dr. Hurt to conduct research on the effect of mustard gas on living organisms. The phrase living organisms was a code name for people, wasn't it? Gill asked Blomma. Dr. Blomma kept stonewalling. On the whole subject of SS research, his attitude was always that it was so secret that not even the Reich chief medical advisor knew anything about it, Major Gill wrote in his report. Gill was convinced that Dr. Kurt Blomma was lying. He felt certain that Drs. Hagen, Hurt, Blomma, and the SS were connected to medical research on prisoners at concentration camps. This interrogation was extremely unproductive, a frustrated Major Gill summarized in his report. Although I do not wish to be definitive, my first impression is that Blomma is a liar and a medical charlatan. Down south in the Bavarian Alps, while the V-2 rocket scientists angled for a deal with the U.S. Army, George Ricke, former general manager of the Middlework, tried to blend in. Ricke had taken a job 90 miles from Nordhausen, running operations in a salt mine. For several weeks, no one was looking for him. Then, Colonel Peter Beasley, of the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey, USSBS, arrived in the area on a mission from the War Department. Beasley's job was to locate the engineers who had built the fortified underground weapons facilities in the Harz. These bomb-proof bunkers were extraordinary engineering feats, and the USSBS was impressed with how so many of them had withstood relentless Allied air bombing campaigns. The rocket facility at Nordhausen was of particular importance to USSBS officers, and Colonel Beasley set up shop in an abandoned barracks just north of the former Middlework factory in a town called Ihlfeld to investigate. As circumstance would have it, the barracks he chose to occupy was the building in which the former office of George Ricke was located. From documents and equipment left behind, Colonel Beasley learned that Ricke possessed extremely valuable information about how the tunnel factory had been built. Beasley asked around, but none of the locals claimed to know where Ricke had gone. "I made daily visits to the jails in the small towns to see if I could locate anyone who might interest me," Beasley wrote in a report. Eventually, he found a man who gave him a tip. George Ricke was running operations at a salt mine in the Black Forest, the man said. Colonel Beasley sent two officers into the field to track Ricke down. Meanwhile, Beasley and his team followed another lead. "In Blankenberg," Beasley wrote, "we found a school building with some miscellaneous papers bearing the Speer Ministry insignia." From these documents, Beasley learned that George Ricke was the liaison between the Middlework and the Ministry of Armaments. When Beasley's two officers returned with George Ricke in custody, Beasley placed Ricke under arrest and began to interrogate him. He was a nervous little man who smoked incessantly and always brought the conversation back to scientific or technical matters, Beasley recalled after the war. But in the end, he was a most profitable catch. "I've got a job for you," Beasley told Ricke. "I want you to begin right now writing out a full description of yourself and all the activities of the V2 factory and what your people were working on." Ricke complied. When the task was complete, Beasley told the former general manager of the Middlework, "We accept you as an official of the German government. We have patience and time and lots of people. You have lost the war, and so as far as I am concerned, you are a man who knows a lot about rockets. As an American officer, I want my country to have full possession of all your knowledge. To my superiors, I shall recommend that you be taken to the United States." Ricke embraced this news with open arms. He told Beasley that he was a scientist and only wanted to work in pleasant surroundings, like the United States. He agreed to tell Beasley where some important records had been hidden. Ricke took Colonel Beasley to a cave several miles away. There, 42 boxes of worksheets, engineering tables, and blueprints relating to Nordhausen and the V2 had been stashed. This was certainly not Wernher von Braun's document stash, but for the USSBS, it was more than they possessed up to this point. Now that he was in possession of a huge trove of documents, Colonel Beasley realized that he needed to have them translated by someone with technical expertise. He had promised Ricke a recommendation for a job in the United States, but first he needed Ricke to come with him to London to translate and analyze these documents for him. Albert Speer, one of the most wanted Nazi war criminals in the world, was finally captured on the morning of May 23, 1945. He was standing in one of the bathrooms of a friend's castle, Schloss Glücksburg, near Flensburg in northern Germany. Hitler's successor, Grand Admiral Dönitz, had by now moved his new government from Eutin to Flensburg, which was located just a few miles from the Danish border. Speer, a Dönitz cabinet member, had been making the daily 6-mile drive from Schloss Glücksburg to the new government's headquarters. The way Speer told the story of his capture, he had been shaving when he heard the sounds of heavy footsteps and loud orders being delivered in English. Sensing that the end of his freedom had arrived, Speer opened the bathroom door a little, his face half covered in shaving cream, and saw the British soldiers standing there. "Are you Albert Speer, sir?" a British sergeant asked. "Yes, I am Speer," he answered in English. "Sir, you are my prisoner," the sergeant said. Speer got dressed and packed a bag. Outside, on the castle lawn, a unit of British soldiers with anti-tank guns had surrounded Schloss Glücksberg. Speer was arrested and taken away. By the time the British arrested Speer, American officials had known for nearly 2 weeks where he had been hiding out. Speer's previous 11 days in the castle had been spent in discussions with American officials with the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey, USSBS. The head of that organization, Paul Nitz, had managed to be the first person in an international manhunt to track down Albert Speer. Nitz considered Speer his most desired intelligence target, and on May 12, 1945, he boarded his DC-3 from where he was stationed in London and headed to Castle Glücksberg before you could say knife, Nitz recalled after the war. Because Flensburg was in the British zone of control, it was the British who needed to arrest Albert Speer. Until then, Nitz, an American, felt at liberty to get as much information from Speer as he could. "We were looking for absolutely vital information and knowledge, and he was literally the only person in Germany who was in a position to provide it," Nitz recalled years later. Specifically, Nitz's organization wanted to know which Allied bombing campaigns had proved the most devastating against Germany during the war. America was still at war with the Japanese, and the USSBS believed Speer could provide them with information that might help America defeat them. Nitz was joined at the castle by two of his colleagues, George Ball and John Kenneth Galbraith. For the next 11 days, the three men questioned Speer. From inside an elegant sitting room, wallpapered in red and gold brocade, the men discussed which Allied bombing campaigns had done the most damage to Nazi Germany and which had had the least effect. Of particular interest to Nitz, Ball, and Galbraith was how the Reich's armaments industry had been able to hold out for so long. Speer explained that at his initiative, the majority of the Reich's weapons facilities had been moved underground. These weapons complexes had proved to be impervious to even the heaviest bombing campaigns. They were engineering triumphs, their construction spearheaded largely by Franz Dorsch and Speer's deputy, Walter Schieber, Speer said. Speer's secretary, Anna-Marie Kempf, took notes. The only interruption was when the cook for the castle summoned everyone for lunch. Speer did not mention that his deputy, SS Brigadefuhrer Schieber, a chemist, also worked with Speer in chemical weapons production. That would be opening up a can of war crimes-related worms. The Americans were not interested in pressing Speer about his involvement in war crimes, and Speer was certainly not offering up any incriminating evidence against himself. Mostly, he boasted about his ministry's feats. George Ball recalled that only once, maybe twice, during the USSBS questioning, was Speer asked about the concentration camps. "I asked him what he knew about the extermination of the Jews. He said he couldn't comment because he hadn't known about it, but he added that it was a mistake not to have found out," Ball told Speer's biographer, Gita Zerene, after the war. John Kenneth Galbraith was the only one of the three men from the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey who had toured a liberated concentration camp before interviewing Speer. Galbraith had seen the atrocities at Dachau and Buchenwald. He explained, "One was just beginning to hear rumors about Auschwitz." Did Galbraith believe that Speer did not know about the extermination of the Jews? No, I don't believe he didn't know, Galbraith told Zerene. Certainly he knew about all the slave laborers. I remember him saying to us, you should hang Saukel, Speer's deputy in charge of slave labor. And then a few weeks later, Saukel said to us, you should hang Speer. Nice people, weren't they? After 11 days of discussions with the Americans, the British located and arrested Speer. They drove him the 6 miles to Flensburg, where the remaining members of Hitler's government were also arrested. Under an escort of more than 30 armored vehicles, the prisoners were driven to waiting aircraft. There, in a field of grass, the men of Hitler's inner circle were loaded onto 2 airplanes and flown to a top-secret interrogation center codenamed Ashcan. That same afternoon, 100 miles south of Flensburg, at the 31st Civilian Interrogation Camp near Lüneburg, a former Wehrmacht sergeant was making a lot of noise. The officer in charge of Camp 31, Captain Thomas Sylvester, found the man's behavior odd. Wehrmacht soldiers who were prisoners rarely did anything to draw attention to themselves. Captain Sylvester sent for the agitated man, whom he described as a short, ill-looking person in civilian clothing with a black eye patch over his left eye. Face to face with Captain Sylvester, the small, ugly man ceremoniously pulled off the eye patch, revealing a pale, unshaven face. The man then produced a pair of horn-rimmed glasses from his pocket and put them on his face. Heinrich Himmler, the prisoner announced in a quiet voice. With the glasses on, Captain Sylvester recognized Heinrich Himmler at once. Before him stood a man many considered the most powerful man in the Third Reich after Hitler. Himmler was Reichsfuhrer SS and chief of the German police, commander of the reserve army of the Wehrmacht, and Reich Minister of the Interior. That face, the cleft chin and the sinister, smiling eyes. Ever since a drawing of Himmler had appeared on the cover of Time magazine on October 11, 1943, portraying the police chief of Nazi Europe in front of a mountain of corpses, he had become synonymous with evil. Now that the little round glasses were on, Sylvester was certain this person was indeed Heinrich Himmler. Still, Captain Sylvester followed protocol and asked for signature verification. When Himmler had been captured days before, he'd presented forged military papers that identified him as a Wehrmacht sergeant named Heinrich Hitzinger. The signature matched, and Captain Sylvester sent for the most senior interrogator in Camp 31, a captain named Smith. Once Smith arrived, Sylvester ordered Himmler searched again. This time, British soldiers found 2 vials of poison hidden in Himmler's clothes. It was medicine to treat stomach cramps, Himmler said. Captain Smith ordered a second physical exam of the prisoner, and the camp's doctor, Captain Clement Wells, spotted a blue-tipped object hidden in the back of Himmler's mouth. When Dr. Wells tried to remove it, Himmler jerked his head back and bit down. The vial contained poison. Within seconds, the prisoner collapsed. Now Heinrich Himmler was dead. An assistant to Dr. Wells noted in his diary, this evil thing breathed its last breath at 23:14. The war in Europe was over. Germans called it Die Stunde Null, 0 hour. Cities lay in ruins. Allied bombing had destroyed more than 1.8 million German homes. Of the 18.2 million men who had served in the German Army, Navy, Luftwaffe, and the Waffen-SS, a total of 5.3 million had been killed. 61 countries had been drawn into a war Germany started. Some 50 million people were dead. The Third Reich was no more. Heinrich Himmler and Adolf Hitler were dead. Albert Speer was in custody. So were Siegfried Knaemeyer and Dr. Kurt Blomme. Otto Ambros was under house arrest in Jindorf with no one in Syos or Alsace yet having figured out who he really was. Wernher von Braun, Walter Dornberger, and Arthur Rudolph were in custody, working toward contracts with the U.S. Army. George Riquet had a job in London, translating documents for the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey. The future of war and weapons hung in the balance. What would happen to the Nazi scientists? Who would be hired and who would be hanged? In May 1945, there was no official policy regarding what to do with any of them. The question, who is a Nazi, is often a dark riddle. An officer with the Third Army, G5, wrote in a report sent to SHAVE headquarters in May. The question, what is a Nazi, is also not easy to answer. Over the next few months, critical decisions about what to do with Hitler's former scientists and engineers would be made, almost always based on an individual military organization's needs and justified by perceived threats. Official policy would follow, one version for the public and another for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, JCS. A headless monster called Project Paperclip would emerge. Part 2. The scale on which science and engineering have been harnessed to the chariot of destruction in Germany is indeed amazing. There is a tremendous amount to be learnt in Germany at the present time. W.S. Farren, British aviation expert with the Royal Aircraft Establishment. Chapter 6. Harnessing the Chariot of Destruction. What to do about Hitler's former scientists? The fighting had stopped and the Allied forces were transitioning from a conquering army to an occupying force. Germany was to be disarmed, demilitarized, and denazified, so its ability to make war would be reduced to nil, and science and technology were at the very heart of the matter. Clearly, German science must be curbed, noted Army Air Force's Lieutenant Colonel John O'Mara in the Syos report he authored on the rise of the Luftwaffe. But how? World War I had ended with a peace treaty that, among other restrictions, sought to prevent the rise of German air power by forbidding powered flight. The result, explained O'Mara, was as ludicrous as it was tragic. By the time Germany started World War II, its air force was the most powerful in the world. The mistake could not be repeated, and the U.S. procedural guidelines for an occupied Germany, contained in a directive known as JCS, Joint Chiefs of Staff, 1076, promised to nullify Germany's appetite for war. All military research was to cease. Scientists were rounded up and taken to detention centers for extensive questioning. Across the former Reich, Schaeff had set up internment centers where more than 1,500 scientists were now being held separate from other German prisoners of war. The U.S. Army had approximately 500 scientists in custody at Garmisch-Partenkirchen in the Bavarian Alps, including the von Braun and Dornberger group. There were 444 persons of interest detained in Heidenheim, north of Munich. 200 were in Zell am See in Austria, 30 kept at Chateau de Grand Chesnay in France. The U.S. Navy had 200 scientists and engineers at a holding facility in Kochel, Germany, including many wind tunnel experts. The Army Air Forces had 150 Luftwaffe engineers and technicians in Bad Kissingen, Germany, a majority of whom had been rounded up by Colonel Donald Putt. Syos had 50 scientists, including Werner Osenberg in Versailles. But there was no clear policy regarding what lay ahead for the scientists, engineers, and technicians in Allied custody, and General Eisenhower sought clarification on the issue. From Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force in France, he sent a cable to the War Department General Staff in Washington, D.C., asking for specific direction about longer-term goals. Restraint and control of future German scientific and technical investigations are clearly indicated, General Eisenhower wrote. But this headquarters is without guidance on the matter and is in no position to formulate long-term policy. Were these men going to be detained indefinitely, interrogated and released? The War Department responded to Eisenhower's cable by letting him know his query was considered a matter of urgency. Tentative responsibility was assigned to the captured personnel and materiel branch of the Military Intelligence Service, Europe. Now that group was in charge of overseeing the scientists' basic needs, including living quarters, food, and in some cases, pay. But it would be another 2 weeks before the War Department would get back to General Eisenhower with any kind of a statement regarding policy. In the meantime, a number of events were unfolding, in America and in Germany, that would affect the decision-making of the War Department General Staff. In the absence of policy, ideas were floated at the Pentagon. Some, like Major General Kenneth B. Wolfe of the Army Air Forces, took matters into their own hands. General Wolfe was chief of engineering and procurement for Air Technical Service Command at Wright Field, and he supported Major General Knair and Colonel Putt in their quest for capturing Luftwaffe spoils discovered at Völkenrode. But General Wolfe envisioned an even bigger science exploitation program and felt strongly that policy needed to be set now. Wolfe flew to Scheife headquarters in France to meet with Eisenhower's deputy, General Lucius D. Clay, to promote his idea. General Clay told General Wolfe that he was not opposed to such a program, but that now was hardly a good time to broach it. Besieged by the countless demands and the chaotic conditions relevant to ending the war, and the burdensome complexities of planning for the peace, Clay considered such efforts 6 months premature, explains historian Clarence Lasby. General Clay told General Wolfe to come back and talk to him in 6 months. Instead, Wolfe set out for Nordhausen, Germany, where his colleague at the Pentagon, Colonel Gervais William Trichel, was running Special Mission V-2, the top-secret scientific intelligence operation for the U.S. Army Ordnance Rocket Branch. Inside the abandoned rocket production facility in the underground tunnel complex at Nordhausen, Special Mission V-2 was just getting underway. When General Wolfe saw the vast numbers of V-weapons left behind, he became even more convinced that a U.S. program to exploit Nazi science had to happen now. Upon his return to Washington, D.C., General Wolfe wrote to General Clay with a revised idea. Not only did the United States military need to act immediately to capture Nazi armaments, Wolfe said, but America needed to hire the German scientists and engineers who had created the weapons and put them to work in America. If steps to this end are taken, the double purpose of preventing Germany's resurgence as a war power and advancing our own industrial future may be served. Clay did not respond. He had already told General Wolfe to back off for 6 months. Meanwhile, the work that was going on at Nordhausen under the auspices of Special Mission V-2 would greatly influence the future of all the Nazi science programs that would follow. The man in charge of Special Mission V-2, 28-year-old Major Robert B. Staver, was no stranger to the military significance of the Nazis' rockets. While preparing for Special Mission V-2 in London the winter before, Staver was nearly killed by one. He and a British colleague had been working inside an office at 27 Grosvenor Square one afternoon in February when a loud blast knocked both of them to the floor. Staver went to the window and saw a big, round cloud of smoke where a V-2 had exploded overhead. Watching pieces of burning metal rain down from the sky, Staver did a few calculations in his head and determined that the V-2 had likely been heading very directly at the building in which he was working when it blew up prematurely. A few weeks later, Major Staver was asleep in a hotel room near the Marble Arch when he was thrown out of bed by an enormous blast. A V-2 had landed in nearby Hyde Park and killed 62 people. The near-death experiences made him ever more committed to Special Mission V-2. For 6 weeks, Staver worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, studying aerial photographs of Nordhausen supplied to him by the British, and otherwise learning everything he could about V-weapons. As soon as the Allied forces liberated the tunnel complex, Major Staver would be one of the first intelligence officers inside. Now, finally, here he was at Nordhausen. It was May 12, 1945, and though his mission was almost complete, time was running out, because the Russians were headed into this area soon. By U.S. Army calculations, they would most likely arrive in 18 days from Berlin. U.S. Army ordnance believed that the V-2 rocket could help win the Pacific War, and for nearly 2 weeks, Staver had been hard at work. He had overseen the collection of 400 tons of rocket parts, which had been loaded onto rail cars for delivery to the port of Antwerp, from where they would be shipped to the United States. But with his degree in mechanical engineering from Stanford University, Staver knew that the V-2 rocket was a lot more than the sum of its parts. Without blueprints or technical drawings, it was highly unlikely that American engineers could simply cobble the rocket components together and make the V-2 fly. The drawings and blueprints had to have been stashed somewhere near Nordhausen. If only Major Staver could find a German scientist to bribe, he might be able to find out where the crucial documents were hidden. For 2 weeks now, Staver had been traveling through the Harz Mountain, touring underground weapons factories, searching for a clue or a lead as to who might know more about the V-2 document stash. Locals told a wide variety of stories. Some spoke of paperwork going up in flames. Others talked about truckloads of metal trunks being hidden away in abandoned buildings, in beer gardens, and in castle walls. But this was all hearsay. No one could produce a concrete lead, and it was not exactly difficult to understand why. War crimes investigators were also in Nordhausen, asking locals lots of questions. And as Staver trolled for rocket scientists, American GIs continued to dig mass graves for the thousands of corpses found at Nordhausen-Dora slave labor camp. The entire town of Nordhausen still smelled of death. While driving around on his hunt, Staver kept boxes stashed in the back of his army jeep filled with cigarettes, alcohol, and cans of Spam. These valuable black market goods worked well in exchange for information, and finally, Staver got the lead he was looking for. A source told him that there was a V-2 rocket scientist by the name of Carl Otto Fleischer who lived nearby. Fleischer had been an engineer inside the Nordhausen tunnels, as well as the Wehrmacht's business manager, and he knew a lot more than he was letting on. Fleischer reported directly to General Dornberger. He knew things. Staver drove to the scientist's residence with a proposition more powerful than a can of Spam. Major Staver told Carl Otto Fleischer that he could cooperate or go to jail. Important V-2 documents had been hidden somewhere around Nordhausen, Staver said. If anyone knew, Fleischer did, Staver surmised. Dieter Hutzel and Bernard Tessman had indeed told Fleischer about the document stash in the Dorton mine before they fled for the Bavarian Alps. But Fleischer's allegiance was to his colleagues, so he lied to Staver and said he had no idea what Staver was talking about. He pointed the finger at another colleague, an engineer and Von Braun deputy named Dr. Eberhard Reis. Ask Reis, Fleischer said. He was the former chief in charge of the Peenemünde assembly line. When interviewed by Staver, Dr. Eberhard Reis played his own disinformation card, using Major Staver's influence to help spring a third colleague from jail. Walter Riedel, chief of V-2 rocket motor and structural design, had been one of the four men honored at the Castle Varlar event the previous December. Now, Riedel was receiving rough treatment in a jail 80 miles away, in Saalfeld. He had been mistaken by military intelligence as having been Hitler's biological weapons chief. Agents with the Counterintelligence Corps had knocked out several of Riedel's front teeth. His security report listed him as an active Nazi who wore the uniform and the party badge, ardent. Riedel joined the Nazi Party in 1937 and was a member of five Nazi organizations. In a series of interviews with Riedel, Major Staver found him to be a strange bird. Riedel was obsessed with outer space vehicles, which he called passenger rockets. In one interview, Riedel insisted he designed these passenger rockets for short trips around the moon, and that he'd been pursuing space mirrors, which would be used for good and possibly evil. Riedel said he knew of at least 40 rocket scientists besides himself who should be brought to America to complete this groundbreaking work. If the Americans didn't act, Riedel said, the Russians surely would. Staver asked Riedel if he knew where the V-2 technical drawings were hidden. Riedel said he had no idea. Staver was working on a number of problems, all compounded by the fact that the Russians were coming. That much was real. Nordhausen had been liberated by the Americans and was originally designated to be part of the American zone. Stalin protested, saying Russia had lost 17 million men in the war and deserved greater reparations for the greater losses sustained. The Allies agreed to turn over a large swath of American-held German territory to the Soviets on June 1st. This territory included all of Nordhausen and everything in it. But Staver had more to worry about than the Russians. On May 18, 1945, an airplane arrived carrying a physicist and ordnance expert named Dr. Howard Percy, H.P. Robertson. Robertson had been a team leader for Operation Alsace, and now he served President Eisenhower as chief of the Scientific Intelligence Advisory Section under Schaeff. Dr. H.P. Robertson told Major Staver that he intended to take rocket engineers Fleischer, Riedel, and Race to Garmisch-Partenkirchen for interrogation, where they would be held alongside General Dornberger and Wernher von Braun until the War Department General Staff decided on a policy regarding Nazi scientists. Major Staver refused to give up Fleischer, Riedel, and Race. They were his charges, he told Robertson. As far as exploiting Nazi science for American use, Staver and Robertson saw eye to eye. But as far as giving Nazi scientists special privileges, the two men were on opposite sides of the aisle. The idea outraged Robertson, who saw Nazi scientists as amoral opportunists who were hostile to the Allied cause. Dr. Robertson was a mathematical physicist who had taken a leave of absence from a professorship at Princeton University to help in the war effort. He was a jovial, gentle man who liked crossword puzzles, Ivy League football matches, and scotch. Robertson spoke German fluently and was respected by Germany's academic elite, not just for his scientific accomplishments, but because he had studied in 1925 in Göttingen and Munich. Before the war, Dr. Robertson counted many leading German scientists as his friends. World War II changed his perspective, notably regarding any German scientists who stayed and worked for Hitler. While at Princeton, Dr. Robertson had become friendly with Albert Einstein. The two men worked on theoretical projects together and spent time discussing Hitler, National Socialism, and the war. Einstein, born in Germany, had worked there until 1933, becoming director of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute of Physics and professor at the University of Berlin. But when Hitler came to power, Einstein immediately renounced his citizenship in defiance of the Nazi Party and immigrated to the United States. Dr. Robertson shared Einstein's core view. It had been the duty of German scientists to protest Hitler's racist policies beginning in 1933. Anyone who had served the Reich's war machine was not going to be given a free pass by H.P. Robertson now. Determined to keep the Nazi scientists in his custody, Staver played the Russian card. Robertson may have been anti-Nazi, but he was also deeply patriotic. With access to secret Alsace intelligence information, Robertson was well aware that Russian rocket development was a legitimate and growing threat. Both men knew that in as little as 12 days, the Russians would arrive in Nordhausen. If Staver was not able to locate the V2 document,